Hey everybody, good day. Welcome to another exciting episode. I always say exciting because I'm not sure if it's me excited, you excited, or the people that watch this excited. But either way, for me, it's another exciting episode of the OIG Roundtable. Good to see my partners in crime on this cold winter day. By the way, I'm in my house in Orlando and it was 38 degrees and I was walking around in shorts and just a hoodie and flip-flops. And I was in the store and people looked at me like I had a mental condition. People were dressed like it was... like they lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Wait, it was a woman walking around the other day, walking the dog. She had on a full length, like North Face coat, puffer coat with a scarf, a hat and gloves. And it was 55 degrees in the afternoon. I was like, my God, this is crazy.
Was the dog dressed the same?
Similarly, yes. Yes, similarly. So anyway, so we're here to talk about a few things. Of course, I've got Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the Los Angeles field office, a director now on our investigative team. And of course, Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from the OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now the senior director of our payment integrity team. And Christopher Walken's stand-in, stunt double. I heard stunt double. Mostly for cowbell related purposes.
And balls of fury. I had to step in and play some ping pong.
Yeah. Exactly. So we want to revisit. So you know that we've probably discussed this topic several times over the past few years. We want to go back and continue some of the conversations regarding when you're doing medical record reviews and the selection of those records. It's an important piece because a lot of cases end up resulting in a need for medical record reviews. And of course, one of the problems that always comes about with medical record reviews outside of selecting the records to review is the backlog that then gets created within an SIU. And we know we see this across payers constantly. They're just number one, there just aren't enough auditors out there who can do this job well. That's just a systemic problem with our industry. You have a lot of people who are coders and they're great at coding. But auditing is a different animal. The one thing I always will say when people come to me and they'll ask me what certification should I get, and I always say after a CPC, if you want to get into this space, fraud, waste, abuse, compliance, the next area you should be looking at is the CPMA because you learn how to actually document your findings and write them up. I will say that that is also not a catch-all. Just because you get a CPMA certification doesn't mean that you're going to be able to do this work. It does take some time and training and a little bit of mentorship to do that. But that becomes a factor, is that you request, if you're in an SIU and you're one of 10 investigators and you've made a medical record request and you have 20 or 30 records and each one of your coworkers has requested 10 or 20 or 30 records and you've got a limited number of auditors on your team, your backlog is going to be huge and you're going to run an issue. So you sometimes need to be judicious and make surgical strikes and how you're going to do those record reviews and make sure that you've got good workflows in place and all of that. It's something we see in the industry on a regular basis. Everybody looks good on paper. Auditors all look good on paper. And then once they get into getting the audits, you find that they're taking very long to do an audit, or it's just not their true wheelhouse. But it always starts with being able to identify what is going to be the right number of records. And we talk about this, Wade, incessantly. We talk about probe sampling, we talk about statistical sampling, and for those that, you know, I always talk about it, Chapter 8 of the CMS Program Integrity Manual, your particular plan or the way that you do sampling may not comport with Chapter 8 of the PIM, but it's always a good idea to take a look at it because Chapter 8 of the PIM talks about how to do SSOE, statistical sampling, overpayment estimation. There are some great people in the industry that I've learned a ton from that do this on the provider side, that do it from the ALJ perspective. And so there are some nuances in it and you have to look at it. First and foremost is that if you're going to do a probe sample, when you look at the PIM says 20 to 40 records. We always recommend that if you're doing kind of your investigative work, you're not vetting a case, but you're in there, take 30 records. It's right in the middle from a plan perspective. You know, we know that a lot of the lawyers that are out there working these appeals and ALJ cases, a lot of them are the same lawyers doing the same work when it's a particular payer. And so they become very conversant in the policies. And oftentimes a good defense lawyer in this space will know the policies and procedures better than sometimes the investigators. And so, you know, it comes down to if Wade and Matt and I are all at the same plan and I'm looking at 20 records and Wade's looking at 30 and Matt's looking at 40, and there's no lack of consistency when you're in a deposition or you're in a hearing, how do you articulate how you came up with 20 or 30 or 40? If you stick with a static number, you're able to articulate that a lot easier because you're just sticking for consistency. But sometimes, Wade, you want to take a smaller number. And I think, you know, the big thing is that you always have to think workflow wise. If you're doing a probe sample and you're taking those 30 records, it's fine. If you're doing a statistically valid random sample, number one, you should have policies and procedures on how you're going to do that and the like. And we'll talk to Matt about that in a minute. But, you know, Wade, sometimes you're going to take a smaller number of records to review. And sometimes that smaller number could be 5 or 10 records. So it's way below that 20 to 40 number. And the reason is because you're using it as a vetting tool. Is there fire where you believe that there's smoke? And it is sometimes a way to identify, does this case need further scrutiny? And, you know, you pull a sample of 5 records and then you find out that those 5 records are problematic and you want to do a bigger sample. Maybe that leads you to wanting to do a statistical sample. Maybe it leads you to wanting to do a probe, and that probe may be another 25 records or something. So talk a little bit about, from an investigator's perspective, if you're looking at these cases, you know, it's always keeping in mind a combination of workflow and, you know, you have cases in different states of investigative, but the importance of probe sampling and the importance of maybe looking beyond a probe sample to a statistical sample.
Right. And I think you kind of covered it there, but as far as, I mean, there's really two different types of probe samples as opposed to SVRS samples. And as you described, you might do a very small one, 5 records or so, just to see if there's anything there, if you just want to invest any resources in the case. If there are, you can still do a probe sample to use kind of as a negotiating tool. If you pull 30 records, again, consistency is key. So if we stick with 30, that's a good plan. But you can use that to talk to the provider. If you pull 30 records and you have a whatever X percentage of overpayment, 90% in that area, you can talk to them about, you know, whether it's, you know, depending on what the universe is, and depending on every case, maybe in the interest of ROI, just having to negotiate that overpayment for that probe sample might make sense. And otherwise, you could use that as a kind of a bargaining tool. Say, look, we looked at 30 records. We have a 90% overpayment rate. We can go ahead and pull an SVRS if it's a state that allows that. Some of the contracts we're in, you can't do, it's illegal to do an SVRS, at least for now. They're working on that. But you can use that as a negotiating tool, saying, look, we have a 90% overpayment with your probe sample that we're talking about, you know, maybe whatever, it could be $50,000, $70,000. However, if we do an SVRS and extrapolate that to the universe, you're going to be looking at, you know, 10 times or whatever, a much larger sample. So that's one way where the probe can be used kind of in two different ways, just to gauge the case or use it as a negotiating tool. So I don't want to go back into like the OI days, but I would just say as a caveat, like in the early 90s, when I first started using RATSTATS, we had, you know, RATSTATS training to understand the basic concepts and understand, you know, confidence levels, frame size, sample size, those types of things. But we had people to do that. We had Office of Audit Services that were kind of co-located with us. And we had auditors that were more used to, that's part of what they did. So as an agent, I really never ran the RATSTAT samples myself. We had somebody else do it. Then we would work with the samples as far as generating overpayments. But we had a statistician who was there for testifying and explaining things in court. Now on the advised contracts, it's a bit different where the investigators all run their own RATSTAT samples. And again, it depends on the case. You might sometimes run an SVRS if that state allows it. Sometimes you may go with the probe depending on the case itself. But as we were talking about before, be careful about a RATSTAT sample because the number of records are going to be much larger.
Yeah.
So there's definitely benefits to doing a RATSTAT sample as SVRS. Your ROI, if you have a decent overpayment percentage, is going to be much higher. If you're going to extrapolate to the whole universe, it's a lot more work.
Right.
So that's one of the things to keep in mind. The other thing is, as I think we talked before this, it's to actually generate the sample is not terribly complicated. There's a RATSTATS user guide, which could probably be rewritten. We have like a Cliff Notes version. We've had a couple versions of the Cliff Notes version. I think Matt, you updated the last one, which made it more clear than the version before that. It's mm-hmm. So now we have a pretty good, easy to follow instruction that I think most of the investigators are able to do and generate their own RATSTATS samples if they can extrapolate. Right. I think the key thing here, though, is to have a data scientist or somebody behind the scenes, doesn't necessarily have to be running the samples, but is able to speak to the methodology and the how we came about using it, why we use it. So if you're going to have to be deposed, or if it's going to go to court, every case should be worked as though it's going to go to some kind of hearing or court. But it's very important to have a data scientist who really has that knowledge beyond what the typical SIU investigator or even the OI agent in the old days had, that would be able to go and speak to a judge or a jury as to, or defense counsel as to how we came about the sample, why it's a legitimate sample, why the extrapolation is allowed, things of that nature. That can get a little bit beyond a lot of SIU investigators or agents' expertise to be able to thoroughly and like simplify that explanation for a judge or jury or defense counsel. So that's a key point. We can do the work in the SIU. We can generate the sample. We can work on generating the overpayment, but to have a data scientist with that experience is very important to be able to back that up.
Yeah. So the key point is, the more complex your sampling needs to be, the less that an investigator should be part of that sampling methodology. You know, when you're talking about how investigators are doing their own sampling, it's really when it's a very basic kind of single one. And we'll talk about that in a second with Matt. But I think that, you know, the key takeaway is that while investigators can be trained on how to use RATSTAT, you always have to have a methodology behind that that's been vetted by a statistician who has said, yes, this is the right methodology. Because at the end of the day, when a defense attorney or provider or whomever is challenging your loss amount, your statistical extrapolation, the two things that you attack are, one, you attack the methodology, two, you attack the audit itself. If your methodology is able to be replicated, which is the important piece of this, then as long as your methodology is sound and it follows the science of statistics, then you're left with an argument about whether or not the results of the audit are correct or not. Because at the end of the day, all the opposing side needs to do in a statistically valid random sample extrapolation is show that one claim was denied or changed inappropriately. Then the entire sampling goes away because your error rate is based upon the whatever the universe is that you've looked at. So it's important to make sure that if your methodology is good, then you could have an instance where you're basically just having a disagreement, which is a battle of experts, and that's fine. But you want to at least make sure that you have control over some of that. And so, Matt, you know, we've put together sampling guides. We've had our statisticians put together policy. We review policy for plans all the time. We've got our own in-house policy. We have a guide. We've got screenshots. RATSTATS is an important piece of the metric. And, you know, for people that have never used RATSTATS, you could watch a YouTube video or two, and you could read the guide that we've got and sit alongside of an investigator that's conversant, and you're good to go in probably an hour. And if you've got a strong statistics background, by the way, one thing that we've learned is that many people that do biostatistics and do this work, they understand the CPT relationship, HCPCS, ICD-10. They don't know RATSTATS because they're using other tools. RATSTATS is not necessarily used in the commercial space very often, but it's used. It is an old chunky program that still works. I know a lot of the statisticians that we use, and even our in-house statisticians, we have a couple of them here. While they both came from CMS and they've used RatStats before, they're very big on using things like Python and R and SQL and things of that sort. So, you know, you get somebody who has a really strong statistics background. They may not have used RatStats, but they're not afraid to delve in and figure it out. And we had a statistician that we used who hadn't used RatStats before, and within a half an hour was probably more expert in using RatStats than people that have been using it. But it still gets down, Matt, to at the end of the day, you've got to have a good guide for your investigators. You have to have good training. You have to have a policy. And the important piece of the policy is the policy has to be almost like a compliance program for the payer, for the provider community. It's got to be a living, breathing document because the laws change, the rules change, and the way that you attack it change. So let's talk a little bit about what are some of the key points of that.
Yeah, let's look at policy from a couple of points of view. One is when to use it, and the other is how to use it. So, you know, if you look from an SIU's perspective, there is a continuum of remedies that you can use: education, probe, post-pay, prepay, statistical extrapolated overpayment, all the way up to, you know, for some of the government programs, exclusion, termination, things like that. So you should have policies that outline the criteria for when you use those different approaches. When is it proper to do a probe sample? What is the criteria needed to use an statistical sampling to do an extrapolation? You know, is it because it's the loss amount, it's the program integrity history of the provider, whatever it might be? You should have those criteria in place and follow those, because you don't want to be on the witness stand or doing a deposition and the defense attorney said, well, Dr. Smith, you had a case on, you just did a probe sample, it was the same type of history as this one, why did you have my client do an have to go through an extrapolated overpayment? You have to be consistent in the approaches that you use across the facts of the case. So that's the when to use it. How to use it, it's the same thing. You have to have policies in place as to what is the methodology, who's doing it, what is the background, and how is it defensible, so that every approach is consistent. That's very important. And the other thing is, as you said, it's got to be a living document, because precedents change all the time. There are arguments constantly amongst the statistician world as to what is a proper methodology. For example, now I think the big controversy is, do you add non-paid claims into the universe, or is it just paid claims? That, you know, that's an ongoing, when I was with the UPIC, it was an ongoing debate between the UPIC statisticians and the MAC statisticians, who were both for the government. So we were going into, doing these, extrapolated overpayments that our own victim, the MAC, wouldn't support. So you have to be consistent and know what those precedents are and make a decision on which, how you're going to follow it, and follow it every time.
That's hugely important. And that's kind of a unique situation, because you've got, right, in most instances, outside of the Medicare world, the payers are all encompassed, right? Whereas in the government space, the SIU of Medicare or the UPICs, the payers or the MACs. And so that's a little unique when you don't have the MAC and the UPIC on the same page with things. And that presents a little bit of a challenge, because they're both supposed to follow the PIM. They're both supposed to be using RatStats and things of that sort. The zero paid claim is now coming to the forefront. I've seen a lot of recent things out there from law firms that talk about zero paid claims. And for those that aren't intimately familiar with this as a topic, the theory of zero paid claims is that a claim wasn't paid. It's a zero pay. The claim was submitted for whatever reason on the claim itself, it was denied. So there's typically some sort of technical issue with the claim. And if we get right down kind of the brass tacks, it's not considered a clean claim. right? So it's the claim was denied for some issue that you'd have to go back and look at a reason code or an error code to understand that. But a zero paid claim is a claim that is denied, and it is typically denied because of something within an edit or an algorithm on the payer side. The argument that lawyers have been making that are very conversant in this space is that there may be some technical issue with why it was denied, but that could be cured through something else, or that they take an issue with the fact that this claim was denied erroneously and should have actually been paid once you review the documents. And so the argument is that you have to include zero paid claims because when you actually put a human to review that claim, somebody who's an auditor reviewing that claim might say, hey, this claim should have been paid for whatever the reason is. There could be a myriad of reasons. And so the argument is that by removing a zero paid claim, you're skewing what your possible overpayment or results are, because you might have a claim that's denied, but it might have actually been payable. A great example is a claim that's submitted as a level 4 or a level 5 at an urgent care, right? Where you typically wouldn't see a level 4 or level 5 at an urgent care. However, there might be an instance where a level 4 or a level 5 might be payable. And so it might be that there's a denial in place because it's coming from an urgent care, and typically an urgent care doesn't see people that are near death or death, right? And so this might be an instance where it's a zero paid claim, but could otherwise have been payable, and someone would need to review that. And so if you're putting together a policy or you're putting together your methodology, this is one of those times where you really need to have a conversation with whoever it is that's writing your policy or your statistician, which is where you may need to just have a blanket policy about whether you're going to include zero pay claims, or you're having a policy that says we're not going to include zero pay claims, but you've got to have a really articulable reason for why you're not going to include a zero paid claim. So Matt, the last thing, and I want to get this to you, is the day-to-day investigator doing their work can run RAT stats, can do this work, but there are instances when you're going to want to bring your statistician in, not just from a consulting perspective, but you might want to bring your statistician in to actually do the review, do the sample, do the extrapolation, because there's some nuance to that case. And that's why you need to have a statistician that you can fall back on. What would be an example where you're going to say, hey, Joe Schmo investigator, you should not be running RAT stats because this is a little bit above your mathematical pay grade?
It's when you go beyond the single attribute type of thing where you know anybody can define a universe as, you know, E&M codes at this level for 1 year that were paid this amount through their fee schedule. That's a pretty simple thing to get your statistical sample and extrapolate from there. But if, let's say, you're going across many years where the fee schedule changes or the criteria, the policies change, and you've got to have multiple universes and you have to, you know, break those down, or if there's multiple codes you want to bring into it and different strata, that's when you want to bring in the statistician to help you define the frames and then work with you on, you know, probably doing multiple samples and multiple extrapolated amounts. Jean Marie's calling me.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, an important piece of this is that if you are not sure, that's the ultimate thing.
Yeah.
If you're not sure, if it's not crystal clear, and by crystal clear, I mean, I'm looking at an E&M code for a 2 year period, boom, simple. If we're looking at a 4 year period or a 5 year period, we're looking at multiple codes, and then you have to start to get into the nuanced statistical vernacular of stratifying samples and, you know, things of that sort, that's where it's worth consulting your statistician to say, hey, is this something that I could just be doing here in RAT stats? Should you be doing it? What do we need to do? And I think that's where you need to have that consulting statistician on board to give you the ability to whisper in their ear about things, but also be able to defer to them when that need arises, when you need to make that deferral. So important. So to wrap up, a couple of things. One, first and foremost, on the payer side, do you have a policy for statistically valid random sampling? Do you have a policy for probe sampling? You should have policies for both. It could be the same policy. You break them up into A and B, be fine. be fine to do that. Look at chapter 8 of the Program Integrity Manual. Don't reinvent the wheel if you don't feel the need to. If the chapter 8 of the PIM works for you, adopt portions of chapter 8 of the PIM and you'll be good, you know, you'll be good to go. So it's important to have a policy. It's important to review that policy on a regular basis. Important to have your statistician review that policy on a regular basis. And again, to probe or not to probe, statistical sampling or not statistical sampling, you don't have to have necessarily a policy about when you're going to do a probe or when you're going to do a statistical sample. Just know that if you're going to do one or the other, that you're going to be incorporating a delay in your ability to finish your investigation because you are having to wait upon getting those records reviewed and a queue that your auditing team, whether they be nurses, whether they be CPCs, we could have an entirely separate conversation, by the way, about whether or not the auditors that you're using should be at the documentation level, the clinical documentation level, or a hybrid, meaning should you be using a CPC level for documentation or should you be using an RN-CPC for clinical documentation? And if you are a Program Integrity Manual geek like I am a little bit, and you go through and you actually do some keyword searches for medical necessity for CMS in the PIM, you're going to find that for the most part, those references are relative to documentation level, not necessarily clinical. An auditor cannot make a clinical determination about the medical necessity of something. We could have an entire separate podcast about where that line is drawn between how medical necessity is clinical or is documentation. And when a documentation auditor is discussing medical necessity, what they really mean. But you need to be able to incorporate those things into your policies, and that creates a little bit of that challenge. But you know, look at what you've got. And if your plan doesn't have a statistician, it doesn't mean that you need one, but you need to have access to one. We have our statistician. We lend our statistician out on a regular basis because in some instances, payers that are small don't need to have someone, you know, in that capacity. Other larger plans have full-time statisticians. You just need to be able to look at those and kind of figure it out. So it's an ongoing discussion. The biggest thing is that the case law is constantly changing. ALJ laws and the rulings of ALJ is constantly changing, and you have to keep up with these things. So it's an ongoing topic, and I know we've talked about it. We'll probably continue to talk about it. So keep up with it. I would say if anybody is out there and they pull down a copy of RATSTATS, don't freak out when it looks like Pong. If anybody is familiar with Pong or any video games from the 80s, it just hasn't been updated for many, many years, but it works. It's tried and true. It's written into the Program Integrity Manual. It's the OIG standard. And so don't be afraid of it. It's not that hard to use. You just need to spend some time. You could really just watch some YouTube videos and then you'll figure it out. So again, anybody looking for some help on this, we have a manual, we have a guide. We provide training on RATSTATS, both with our statistician and our in-house team. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, we appreciate everybody taking the time to watch and listen to our podcast. Again, you can catch it on Spotify. You can catch it on YouTube. Just go to YouTube, put in the search bar, Advise Health, and you can find it. You can just Google it or whatever your preferred search engine is, and you can find the OIG Roundtable each week, as well as copies of our recorded versions after the fact of our LinkedIn Live. So as always, we appreciate everybody spending the time, and we'll see you all on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody. Stay warm in the winter.
Thank you.
Thank you all.